Of the nearly 4 million public school children who begin ninth grade each year, 25% won't make it to graduation. In fact, there are currently 40 million Americans who never graduated from high school. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that there's been a growing movement toward school privatization, with the corporate sector positioning itself for a piece of the pie. More recently, venture capitalists and so-called education entrepreneurs have been pushing for virtual schools, which allow for-profit companies to administer public schools completely online without classrooms or traditional teachers. Investigative journalist Li Fang, in partnership with the investigative fund at the Nation Institute, examines this growing movement in an article in the December 5th edition of The Nation called How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools. Li Fang joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm okay. It's quite clear that in most cases, our current version of public education isn't working. We lag behind most nations in math and science and have a ballooning dropout rate. So why not try the privatization of schools K to 12?
Well, I think I could maybe at first challenge that assumption to some degree. You know, some of the best performing schools in America are public schools, but they're in areas where there are good funding mechanisms for schools, like in Montgomery County, Maryland, or Fairfax County, Virginia. But I agree that there should be innovation and there should be a discussion on how to solve this education crisis that we're going through.
Well, many of the best schools are in areas where wealthy people live and their property taxes are higher, and they're willing to pay for better schools. But we don't have an even funding around the country.
Certainly, and that is something that should be addressed, but I think a lot of folks are taking this problem that we can all agree on, the failure to graduate enough students, the low test scores, the litany of other problems, but the solutions that are being proposed aren't necessarily a quick fix, and the way that they're being sold to people, they don't address the lack of research that shows that these school privatization efforts don't really deliver for students as they're promised.
When did online schools first start making their entry into the educational system?
Well, a couple companies, such as Edison Learning, really made a large push towards the middle of the dot-com bubble in the late 90s. Some of them got a small start with pilot programs in the Philadelphia area and Arizona and some other places, but they pretty much floundered, and many of these companies failed. There were several funding scandals involving these schools, and they never really caught on with the public.
So why are we hearing about them again today in what some people might describe as a kind of a frenzy to privatize America's educational system?
Well, there's been a slow buildup over the past couple years, and you could say a perfect storm has been created in the last 2 years, where several venture capitalists who have been looking at this market, they've looked at the $500 billion to $1 trillion in K through 12 education that is spent through the public sector that hasn't been privatized, and they've seen an opportunity that they've worked towards. And unlike 10 years ago or 15 years ago, when there were previous attempts at large-scale education technology privatization, there's a political infrastructure in place. And that's what my piece really explores, the different foundations, the lobbyists, and the politicians who have been working with some of these companies to radically change some of the laws governing K-12 education.
So you're suggesting that this has a political aspect to it. Would we say, is it reasonable to say that opponents are more likely to be liberals and supporters are more likely to be conservatives?
You know, I think that's yet to be seen. I think the more traditional proponents of public education are liberals, I suppose, but I think there's a growing backlash against what some folks on the right call crony capitalism. They see that a lot of these companies, they only succeed through lobbyists. They hire legions of folks from K Street and lobbyists from other state capitals throughout the country to make their companies succeed by finding large subsidies, grants, and other forms of taxpayer money. And I think there's a growing anger against that in the Tea Party as well. So, you know, these laws are just being enacted just in the last year or two on a large scale. We haven't seen the coalition really form yet, but there are certainly many critics across the board.
Laws enacted where?
Well, just this year, there were big laws enacted in Florida, Wisconsin, Ohio, many of these states where Republicans did very well in 2010. I think overall, in the last 14 to 16 months, 13 states have passed so-called school choice laws, many of them voucher laws that allow public money to go to for-profit enterprises like these virtual schools. And 27 states have laws like these pending, with two states actually enacting laws that require high school students to take online courses for graduation.
My guest is Li Fang, whose article, How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools, is in the current issue of The Nation, the December 5th issue. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what is a virtual school and how does that work?
There are several different models. Some are called blended learning, but the basic virtual school model is simply instead of sending your child to a brick-and-mortar classroom, they stay home with a computer and log in and are expected to fill out the day doing their coursework through their computer. There are some programs where they will check in with the teacher every couple of days, some of them every day. Some of them in the blended learning model will actually go to a physical building and take a few classes there and then spend the rest at home, or go to a computer lab and take their classes there while a supervisor keeps them on task. But overall, it's basically just learning at home through the computer.
Are teachers replaced with avatars?
In a sense, they are. Students will log in. I mean, there are many different curriculum programs, but students will look through the different coursework and in some ways teach themselves, where a teacher is helping them curate, but it's up to the student to make sure that they're actually on task. And in some cases where teachers are being replaced by avatars, in other places they're being replaced by parents, and parents are expected to come in and make sure that their student isn't or their child isn't goofing off or even really paying attention.
Well, how is this any different from distance learning, which was touted as an educational savior for kids in rural areas with little access to good schools or qualified teachers?
There's an important place for distance learning, and in many ways it's quite similar. You know, for students on remote islands or in rural areas where they don't have access to high-quality education or AP classes, you know, virtual schools or distance learning makes a lot of sense. However, what's different about this and this large-scale reform, you're taking students that do have access to public schools, and they're being sold a program where they spend all of their time on the computer, even though there isn't necessarily a need for them to be online when they're just learning basic arithmetic, reading, and science.
Well, where does homeschooling come into this picture?
Well, I think virtual school companies have seen or have observed that homeschoolers are big advocates of this. And they've marketed a lot of their materials towards them. And I think that's what's helped some of these companies when forging alliances with conservative advocacy groups, because they've hidden largely behind conservative philanthropies when introducing this idea or proposing this idea in various states.
So who ultimately makes the choice? Is this the choice of the student, the parent, or are some states actually requiring that people go to these virtual schools?
Well, some states, Florida and Idaho, now have the requirement that some classes, at least one or two classes, are taught online for students to graduate. In some places where there are drastic budget cuts, like the Miami-Dade County public school system, they simply force students to take a large number of students force them to take virtual school courses because they didn't have the money to hire the teachers. But in most cases, this is something that is opt-in. The parents use the voucher or the opportunity scholarship, whatever they call it, and they have different names in each state, to attend a virtual school.
Advocates say that this approach is necessary for those who are at risk of dropping out or don't participate well in traditional classrooms. Does online learning play some role for these students? Does it help them?
I think the jury's still out on that. There's some research into this type of education, and overall it shows that students perform much worse, not only when paired against traditional public schools, but also just against traditional charter schools that are in brick-and-mortar buildings. Some of these numbers are kind of jarring, and the University of Colorado found that 30% of for-profit virtual schools fail to make the progress outlined by No Child Left Behind. In some places, like in Ohio, there's the largest operator of for-profit virtual schools. In 1 month, the state was paying the school for 2,000 students, but only 7 logged in. I think there are opportunities for technology to play a very important role for students with special learning needs. However, the type of experimentation on a grand scale, I haven't seen the research.
Well, this sounds like it would set off all sorts of alarm bells, and yet we seem to be moving further and further in this direction. A listener asks, is there a slippery slope between charter schools and privatization? Because charter schools do take money out of the public school system.
There are many different charter models. That being said, you have to read between the lines, because a lot of the charter laws allow. Here's a better example. In Indiana, they changed the charter law, allowing pretty much any university to authorize a new charter. So that means possibly a fly-by-night university can now authorize a charter that might not really meet the grade in previous years and start offering services. And those charters that are authorized usually outsource the curriculum and their management to a for-profit company. That being said, you have to look on a case-by-case basis.
Janny on the Lower East Side asks on our show page, my biggest concern is this. Won't privatizing public education do the same thing privatizing the prison system and healthcare system has done?
Well, this is one of my first investigations into K-12 education. I've spent a lot of time reading, writing, and investigating the healthcare industry, particularly health insurance, and the type of wide-scale privatization we're seeing in K-12 education. Part of my article looks at a conference for venture capitalists, and they're explicitly making the argument, we did this to healthcare in the 90s. Education, particularly K-12 education, is the next quote-unquote undercapitalized market. It's the last big part of the American economy that hasn't been privatized. So they see it as a cash cow. We'll see it how far they can take it, though.
Li Fang's article, How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools, is in the current issue of The Nation. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Li Fang, whose article, How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools, it's in the current issue of The Nation. Li, who's writing the curriculum for these online courses?
It really ranges. Some of the big for-profit virtual school companies, K-12 Inc., Connections Academy, and some others, they have some of their own curriculum programs, but they also outsource it to other companies as well. There are smaller companies that specialize in this sort of thing, especially for virtual schools.
And who are there? Is their work graded by anybody?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Here, there's been several controversies about that. K-12 Inc., for instance, a few years ago was caught in Arizona with their Arizona Virtual Academy outsourcing the grading of some of their essays to a Texas-based company, which then outsourced it to a company in India. And none of that was disclosed to parents, so there are some privacy issues there.
But there's also a lot of money seems to have exchanged hands, because every time you send it to another place, somebody makes a little money.
That's right. And in many cases, these companies are making $6,000, $7,000 per pupil. And they're finding ways to cut costs even beyond not having to have a small teacher-to-student ratio or physical schools. And in many cases, you know, it's the parents that are forced to do this. You know, so several researchers tried going through the K-12 Inc. Curriculum for elementary school students and found that large portions of it were expected to be, a lot of the burdens were placed on parents. There were printouts of coloring coursework, and students had to identify different characters and then color them in and then bring them to their parents to check if they did it correctly. Same with essays in middle school offered by the same company. Students were asked to write essays, and then basically there's no way to turn them in. Presumably they had their parents again looking at them.
Is it assumed in most cases that the parents are at home during the day?
It's assumed. I suppose that's the assumption, but this isn't marketed just towards homeschoolers. This is marketed towards parents of all types as a simple replacement for public school.
I'd imagine that in some cases there are good things happening. iPads are entering the classroom. There must be a whole host of really incredible applications and courses that students can take online. Have you come up with any?
Yeah, there are very interesting technological advancements. And, you know, I've written this article, and, you know, I've read some of the feedback, but no, I should be clear that there are a lot of positives in the use of technology. I think that the concern overall is the move towards for-profit incentives in K-12 education, but there are great lecture series and AP coursework that's available online. You can have high school students taking college coursework when you have very advanced lectures being placed on podcasts or video and beamed directly to schools or beamed directly to students who are capable of taking those classes. I mean, I think that's a wonderful breakthrough.
But this is all being paid for by taxpayer dollars, isn't it?
That's right.
So I start a company and I offer my services online. And then then the state or the local school board, instead of paying teachers, pays me?
There's different arrangements, but essentially that's how it works.
And venture capitalists are going to this field. I understand Rupert Murdoch is one of the people involved?
Right. Shortly after the 2010 midterms, which a lot of people have you know, addressed on how it changed the composition of Congress, but the bigger effect of the 2010 midterms was down ballot. Republicans made massive gains in state legislatures and governorships, and they saw and News Corporation saw the shift and announced a big acquisition, buying a Brooklyn-based company called Wireless Generation, which helps companies keep tabs and deliver different types of metrics on schoolwork as it happens.
I like the fact that you use the word matrix.
Yeah, it might be appropriate. But if you listen to K-12 Inc.'s investor calls, I think it's interesting because you listen to their calls shortly after the midterm elections, and it's not about the different types of innovative products that they have coming down or the different technologies that they're offering students. If you listen to one of their investor calls, it sounds like a legislative strategy session where they're just talking about where they can help change the laws in different states and gain new business. I think the public would have quite a reaction if they listened to some of these calls.
Well, I guess I'm not surprised because one of the players is Patricia Levesque, who was a top advisor to former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida. There's also the investment banker Michael Moe. Mm-hmm. What is his relation to politics?
Well, Michael Moe was involved in this during the dot-com bubble. He had originally been at Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, but he's been working in this sector for a long time because he's seen it as a potential growth industry. And he was involved in the failures with Edison Learning back in the late 90s. And he's been working with various groups of education reform nonprofits. And in the last 2 years, he's been convening large summits of private equity, venture capital, Wall Street money that's looking to break into this market. And he brings together the political people, the Jeb Bush foundations, some of the other Education Reform Now and School Choice Week, these newly created groups just in the last 2 years, with the folks who are trying to invest in this sphere.
But are Bill and Melinda Gates, is their foundation, and the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, are they involved in this as well?
Well, they're some of the big name foundations that for years have been involved with education reform, addressing this crisis that you spoke about in the beginning of your show. But the interesting thing here is that a couple years ago, in 2007, they changed their giving philosophy. Before, they'd pretty much only funded charter programs, Teach for America, that sort of thing. And in 2007, they switched to more political giving. They paid several D.C. lobbying firms to orchestrate a public relations campaign to convince the public that massive reforms were needed. And in the following years, they started funding groups with a much harder edge politically, including the Philanthropy Roundtable. And these groups, in turn, have pressed these types of for-profit virtual school reforms very aggressively. And I think the interesting thing here with a massive foundation like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Dell Foundation, as they're funding these political initiatives to shift towards virtual schools, they're companies where they derive their wealth, the Dell Computer Corporation and Microsoft, are also simultaneously moving into the sphere, offering for-profit products to take advantage of these reforms.
My guest is Li Feng. His article, How Online Learning Companies Bought America's Schools, it's in the current issue of The Nation. What's the average cost to the state or the local school district of educating a child online versus in the traditional classroom?
It ranges. Every state has enacted pretty much different laws. In Pennsylvania, currently, they have a very limited program. They're actually, in the next few weeks, expected to try to change this law and expand it, but for-profit virtual schools can receive, I believe, about 80% of the money that would go to a pupil. In Florida, there's a non-profit virtual school program that costs the state about $2,500 less than they would have spent on a traditional school. In Tennessee, however, where they just enacted a virtual school law written by K-12 Inc. lobbyists, the virtual schools get 100% of the money that would have been spent in traditional school, and that's about $6,000.
Well, you mentioned Pennsylvania. Wasn't there a study of virtual schools in Pennsylvania recently conducted by Stanford University?
Yeah.
What did they find?
Well, they found that initially, when students kind of began in a virtual school, their test scores were about on par with traditional brick and mortars. But as they progressed, they actually performed significantly worse than those in charters or in public schools.
Well, they're not with other kids, and they don't have teachers motivating them. Should we be surprised?
I think that's the other big question. You know, that there hasn't been enough research, but the obvious effect, I think, to anyone is the effect of socialization. I think a lot of folks have legitimate worries about bullying and a lot of the nasty aspects of socialization. But, you know, public schools were supposed to be the great equalizer. They introduce you to folks that you might not ordinarily meet, and the process of making friends and dealing with bullies is important.
Now, how does the industry explain the results that the Stanford study revealed?
I haven't seen them respond directly to many of these studies. Mostly because they have a much bigger megaphone. I haven't seen them forced to respond to most of them. They have a very convincing argument that the public schools are failing. States don't have enough money to meet their budgetary requirements in terms of public schools, and this is a solution that can satisfy everyone's problems. And it's something that they've worked with both Democrats and Republicans to sell very efficiently.
Can you tell us about ALEC's Virtual Public Schools Act in Tennessee and who was behind the drafting of that legislation?
One of the largest virtual school companies, Connections Academy, which was recently bought by the company Pearson's, they're based in Baltimore, but their main state lobbyist, Mickey Ravenel, is the chairwoman of a task force from ALEC, this group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, that basically ghostwrites legislation for state lawmakers. Well, she got placed with a donation, of course, to ALEC as the head of their education law writing committee, and this is a private group based in Washington, D.C., and she authored what's called the Virtual School Act, along with other members of that task force. And in August of this year in New Orleans, they approved another version of this law, as well as a list of other, basically a wish list of different virtual school priorities, such as, you know, increasing state funding for those sorts of programs. And that law was then distributed to the hundreds of different state lawmakers who call themselves members of ALEC, mostly Republicans, but some Democrats, but they're in every state house. And in some states, it's the majority of legislators.
Now, you've mentioned Jeb Bush a number of times. Hasn't Florida become the epicenter for the virtual school approach?
Well, Florida was the original epicenter in the late 90s, as when Jeb Bush was governor. He introduced some of the first charter school, statewide charter school laws, as well as the Florida Virtual School, which is a nonprofit. And he pressed to expand those programs. Some of them were struck down as unconstitutional. But, of course, he left the governorship, and Republican-turned independent Charlie Crist took over, and the laws and the pace of reform really lagged. It wasn't until this year, with the election of Tea Party-aligned Governor Rick Scott did Florida again start pushing these laws incredibly aggressively, introducing not only the online course requirement, but expanding the authorizers of charter schools, expanding the opportunity scholarships, the vouchers that can go to for-profits and online schools, doing a number of things that have made Florida really the center of all of this.
Now, how does this work with federal laws and federal approaches, No Child Left Behind and President Obama's Race to the Top? Are they applied in any way?
Well, in some ways, it's been incentivized by the federal government. President Obama's stimulus actually provided some test funds to bring more technology into the classroom, and in some cases, incentivize school systems to move towards the virtual education approach. That being said, you know, the biggest counter-argument to virtual schools has been the data that's required by No Child Left Behind. If you look at the numbers from the Stanford University study to the University of Colorado and others, they found that for-profit virtual schools have performed worse, and usually that data is based on No Child Left Behind.
So my feeling from all of this is that you're saying that this is not necessarily a positive development, but in some cases it can work.
I'd say that there's been a large-scale attempt to test these programs out on students, and it wasn't ever sold to voters. No one campaigned on this last year. We're now implementing this year, and there hasn't been a public debate over the effectiveness, and there hasn't been research to show that it works. Obviously, we need innovation, but I think a lot of this has gone on without true public oversight.
Lee Fang's article appears in the current issue of The Nation. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.